In the coming week, U.S. governors face pressure to reopen America. The U.N. Security Council discusses conditions in Syria, and the Islamic holy month of Ramadan begins. It's April 23rd, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, I want to note for our listeners that you and I are practicing social distancing, and we are recording this podcast from our respective homes. And because of that, we apologize in advance for any audio issues that might crop up.
Thanks, Jim. It's almost certain to be the case this time, but let's see if we can do this. And of course, let's start with job one here, which is discussing the virus. There's a new round of jobless data in the United States that seems to only reinforce the desire on the part of some businesses and the public to get back to work. Yet at the same time, many public health experts say it's far too early to do anything like a rolling return to work. It risks producing, in some cases, even more disruptive waves of outbreak, according to these experts. We've had a new plan released by President Trump last week. Some governors had responded cautiously to this. Others are eager to start opening up business again. There's tensions playing out every day on this, Jim. Can you tell us a bit about what the plan is actually saying and prospects for this lockdown easing up?
Certainly, Bob. And I think you're right that the Trump administration's plan for reopening America has met with mixed reviews. Now, a lot of the reaction is along predictable political lines, but I think it's important to keep in mind that it's a really big public policy question here. And that is, how do you best stop the spread of the coronavirus without doing irreparable damage to the economy? And as you noted in your question, the shutdown has had clear economic costs. The figures this morning show that we now have something on the order of 26 million people unemployed. That means that essentially all the job growth since the 2008 recession has been wiped out, and we're looking at an unemployment rate that is probably nearing 20%. So that's a big economic shock. And I think it's important also to note that other countries are grappling with this exact same challenge. Germany is looking to reopen its economy this week. Norway is doing something similar. We have regional efforts here in the United States, New York, and the surrounding states, California, Oregon, and Washington are working together to figure out how to slowly relax many of the restrictions that have been placed over the last month or so. And the challenge is everyone is doing this with no established roadmap for how best to do it because so much about the virus remains unknown. Now, the core idea in the Trump plan is that states and localities should confirm a two-week downward trend in coronavirus symptoms in documented cases before they start easing their lockdowns.
So 2 weeks, the period that they've identified as, that's a clear sign that the sort of community spread is clearly waning.
It's waning in a sense. Now you have the opportunity to begin to ease the lockdown, not necessarily end it exactly, but to start easing it in a sort of a three-phase opening plan that the administration lays out. And again, the idea here is to pursue the opening in such a way that any spike in infections won't overwhelm hospitals. But there are really two big problems with the Trump plan. The first is that the United States still does not have anywhere near the number of test kits to be able to track the spread of the infection accurately enough. And it also lacks the kind of contact tracing you would need to be able to make the strategy work. Contact tracing is the idea of sort of figuring out if someone's infected, who else did they come into contact with, how to isolate those people.
And that's the kind of thing that places like South Korea have been able to do effectively so far.
Yeah, and they have done it very well, but it requires a big commitment of time and energy, people to do it, and then to get people to obey and follow the restrictions on isolating and the like. The second problem with the Trump plan, it's really not really a problem with the plan, is that some states are moving toward reopening before they begin to see the two-week downward trend. And the poster child here has been the state of Georgia, where Governor Brian Kemp has directed that barbershops, nail salons, massage parlors, bowling alleys can all reopen.
And tattoo shops, Jim.
And tattoo parlors as well. And President Trump, in his evening press conference yesterday, said that he strongly disagreed with this decision. But the challenge you have here is that you could see flare-ups of the coronavirus that will not just affect states like Georgia, that have sort of been very aggressive in opening up, but other states, because again, people move about. And I think it's important to stress that this is not a hypothetical concern. I mean, take the case of Singapore. We've talked about it a number of times here on the podcast. It's a country that has often been held up as doing or responding quite well to the coronavirus challenge. But in the last couple of weeks, Singapore has seen a spike in new cases. So you can sort of see these new surges coming. You know, one final thing, I think as many people concerned, is that we actually don't know how much of a boost these reopenings will actually give to the economy. I mean, a lot of this conversation about reopening is operating what I would call the field of dreams principle. If we reopen, the customers will come. But if public opinion polls are right, that a majority of Americans think that it's too soon to relax restrictions, you could possibly get the worst of both worlds. You know, enough people venture out to lead to a spike in infections, which will trigger another round of shutdowns, but not enough to give the economy a sustainable boost.
Yeah. And I'm thinking back to your comment, Jim, about the absence of a playbook for this. And so in the absence, first of all, you continue to have a lot of people trying to look to the federal government for some sort of more granular plan of action that the country can get around. And instead, you have this dispiriting trend of sort of the divisiveness playing out, the liberate slogans for certain states where you have Democratic governors pitted against people who are coming into the streets, some of them with weapons saying it's, you know, they want to take their country back and so forth. And the president seeming to support that at one point. Although, as you said, he did warn Georgia, you know, against going back precipitously. And so in the absence of a playbook, then you have, you know, I guess some of the Asian models that we were talking about, South Korea, Singapore, although it's had some new problems now, Taiwan and others. And so you have these sort of regional groupings of governors that are maybe going to take the lead on this. Are you seeing any other signs, Jim, that there could be emerging some sort of consensus of thought on the approach, or are we still kind of lurching around back and forth in this?
I think we are leaning more toward lurching, Bob, than having any consensus on how to approach things. And part of that's sort of baked into the American political structure, right? We are a republic that is based on the principle of federalism. States have the ability to set rules for themselves. That's recognized in our Constitution. And again, the country's incredibly diverse. The challenges faced in New York City are different from the challenges you might find in Grattinger, Iowa, or Sheridan, Wyoming. And so we have this opportunity here for some flexibility to adapt to what the circumstances are in different states. But again, everything is leavened by a lack of certainty about the exact nature of the challenge we face. We're not really sure in terms of, you know, what percentage of the public has been infected. We are unsure whether this virus is going to sort of peter out as it gets warmer. Some people have suggested that would be the case. But there's the possibility we could see future surges, maybe in the fall. The director of the CDC, Robert Redfield, this past week, gave an interview to the Washington Post in which he suggested the possibility of a second wave. Again, this harkens back to people's historical readings about the Spanish flu, where it first came in the spring of 1918 and then came with real force in the fall of 1918. Could the coronavirus sort of copy that trajectory? Possibly. We don't know. And there are a whole variety of other issues that we're really still struggling to grapple with. You know, state governors, mayors, presidents, go abroad, prime ministers and the like are all trying to sort of figure out how do you map through this uncertain terrain where you obviously want to bring the economy back. I mean, when you're talking about sort of the sharp spike in unemployment, I mean, that's a big deal and it really affects people's lives. But at the same time, what you don't want to do is to take steps that are going to lead to a massive health crisis. And trying to sort of navigate between those two challenges, I think is very difficult indeed to do.
And as this is playing out, the federal government continues to try to come up with, I think they're still calling relief plans. At some point, they'll start calling them stimulus plans that are basically buying time so that a number of businesses, small and large, can kind of tread water or kind of hold their own to some extent until the country can open up. And that's still uncertain. And these enormous, you know, layouts are being added to debt figures and everything else. I saw one estimate in the Washington Post. If you count some of the moves by the Fed, along with the federal government bailouts, and it's like $6 trillion of U.S. debt as the bill that's looming for this year's action so far on the COVID response.
Well, and it's very interesting to sort of watch the reaction here in 2020 and compare it to, let's say, the reaction at the beginning of the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, where there was a lot of resistance to taking big steps, particularly big fiscal steps to address the crisis. I think you're quite right, Bob. This time around, the taps have been turned wide open. The Senate this week has come up with another plan for injecting funds, this one particularly targeted at smaller business owners. The House is expected to come into session to move on that plan. But the real question is, are those efforts going to be enough? And this is why policymaking can be very challenging, because you are trying to make big decisions with big consequences with some dispute about, you know, what the relevant indicators are you should be paying attention to and how well we are or aren't doing. And that's why you get in all this talk about, you know, people hope we're going to be in a V-shaped recession where we sort of come down very sharply and bounce back up very sharply. Other people talk about a W recession, sort of fall sharply. You think it's better days, green shoots, so to speak, then you go back down again. Other people talk about the Nike recession, that is, fall sharply, but then the recovery is going to take a very long time. Nobody really knows. And, you know, obviously people's lives are in the balance, their livelihoods, their futures, their retirement, and what have you. Bob, let's change gears. In the coming week, the UN Security Council is scheduled to meet to discuss the humanitarian situation in Syria. The Security Council meeting is a good reminder that the coronavirus pandemic is not the only issue the world is facing right now. Can you tell us a bit more, Bob, about the meeting and what's currently happening in Syria?
Certainly, there are many things going on beyond the pandemic, but the pandemic seems to be the backdrop to everything. The meeting you mentioned is a virtual meeting. All diplomacy is happening remotely, like many other meetings. And this will be a quote-unquote open meeting, so people will have access to the conversations going on in these meetings. And this is part of the monthly briefing the Council has, as it has for almost a decade now, has on its agenda, peacemaking efforts in Syria. It has been one of the bigger failures of the Council in its history, I would propose, partly because there are major members, veto-wielding members of the Council who have vested interests in Syria, and it is impeding the ability to move forward in any sort of successful fashion. Now, they had a briefing. This will be, I believe, the second major briefing on Syria since the virus went global, was declared a pandemic. And the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Mr. Peterson, has already outlined kind of what steps need to take place to both try to bring about once and for all a sustainable peace process, but also how to really ward off a pandemic, which would further devastate Syria given the destroyed nature of its medical infrastructure and general nationwide capacity to respond to something like a pandemic. Now, we've heard of a few cases popping up in the country and in refugee areas, but nothing like a major spread as of yet. There is a ceasefire in the area that's been getting a lot of attention recently. This is the northwestern area of Idlib. There's a ceasefire in early March that was struck by Russia and Turkey, to the big actors in that area. And that seems to be largely holding. There's actually nationwide not been a great deal of fighting going on. There are incidents all the time. But what the UN would love to see is some sort of formalizing of a nationwide ceasefire in Syria and then set in motion a number of other steps they like to call confidence building measures, things like releasing prisoners, improving humanitarian access, waiving sanctions that Syria is facing on multiple fronts, that sanctions that in this case are hurting the ability to fight the pandemic. If they can do that, the UN officials feel like they can maybe start to walk back towards a process, which will be remote for now, but some sort of a peace process that will talk about Syria, an end game, and a new political plan for Syria. This is tough. Syria's government under Assad feels like it's close to just sort of sealing the deal on wiping out all opposition elements. This Idlib area is sort of the last redoubt for opposition fighters. But as I mentioned, Turkey's gotten involved there. There are 1 million or so newly displaced people, many of them living in precarious circumstances, hard up against the Turkish border. They're not going to be allowed to flee the country. So there's a great deal at stake in a place where I think a number of actors have become exhausted in trying to deal with, and yet it's very important that they deal with it. One other element I would add, Jim, is that a lot of the major actors in Syria, outside actors, are all dealing with major stresses related to the pandemic themselves, which gives some people cause to think, you know, maybe they will be less inclined to sort of dig in on their positions on Syria and maybe move towards compromise. It's not clear if that's going to happen. Syria has been through so much in these almost 10 years now, but it is a chance for the world to take notice of what the situation is and what possible steps could be taken.
Bob, just to go back to the connection with the coronavirus, do we have any confidence that we know what's actually happening in terms of the virus's spread in Syria?
You know, because of the absence of what you described as rigorous testing and contact tracing, things like that, I would say it's hard to have a lot of confidence. I would only say that because there are, at least in the refugee areas, enough sort of relief agency officials and monitoring and so forth going on, I think there is an ability for word to get out were there to be any sort of serious signs of an outbreak. So I think it's not under the radar enough that if it happened, it could just spread before anybody knows it's going on. But it's hard to be confident that there are enough walls and preventive measures put up to, especially in Italy, but really nationwide, to protect the country from an outbreak. So it's yet another area to keep an eye on, Jim. We haven't seen the types of reports we've seen in other areas, but there's an inevitability to this outbreak that I think gives us cause for alarm too.
The reason I ask is because there has been a lot of talk, and we've discussed it on the podcast, that the coronavirus takes hold in refugee camps, think in Syria, but think Yemen, think the Rohingya camps elsewhere, that the consequences could be catastrophic. But I haven't seen anything in the news indicating whether we're seeing the beginning of that transpiring or whether they're going to be fortunate and escape sort of the catastrophic scenarios that have been laid out as potential outcomes.
No, it's true, Jim. I think that is the situation at this point. I think the other complicating, confounding factor is that, let's say they do ward off the direct impact of a pandemic, which would be the spread of this nasty COVID-19. But perhaps there are other effects that they're going to deal with. And we had UN officials warning earlier this week about the problem of starvation and hunger spreading in sort of biblical proportions, I think was the word used by the World Food Program director. So that is a great concern. There's an ongoing UN appeal on top of appeals that are happening worldwide for all sorts of reasons to try to help build up a food supply and a distribution network that will help make sure that food is getting to these people. There are hundreds of millions of people identified now as at risk of starvation. This is a type of thing that we haven't seen in a long time. Jim, I want to bring up another topic, which is resonating in the Middle East and elsewhere, and that is the first day of the holy month of Ramadan. Muslims around the world are set to begin a month of daily fasting, prayer, and charity work that's part of this holy month. Can you tell us more about this holiday, but also the obvious impact that the coronavirus is likely to have?
Well, Bob, Ramadan is certainly going to look different this year for many of the world's 1.8 million Muslims. Just as for Jews around the world, Passover was very different, and for Christians, Easter was very different. Ramadan, as you mentioned, is the holiest month in the Islamic calendar. It's going to run from today through May 23rd, and all adult Muslims, with some specific exceptions, are required to fast from sunrise to sunset. Indeed, the fasting is one of the five pillars or obligations of Islam. But in many countries around the world, mosque services have been suspended. Indeed, mosques in Egypt have been suspended for more than a month in an effort to slow down the spread of the coronavirus. And the concern about the virus is going to disrupt the iftar dinners that are traditionally held at the end of each day to break the fast. This is obviously a time for family and friends to get together, but faced with the challenge of the virus, people won't be able to get together. I'll also note that Muslims who are looking to make the pilgrimage to the holy cities of Mecca and Medina during Ramadan won't be able to. Saudi Arabia isn't granting visas to make the trip. And you mentioned, you know, in your question, Bob, about the charitable aspect of Ramadan. Charitable activities are quite important, designed to help the poor. Many of those are being disrupted because people aren't going to be able to go to the mosque and governments don't want people to be congregating. And there's a double whammy, just to go back to our last topic. You know, many of these countries, the virus is disrupting their economies, driving up prices, creating food scarcities that are hardest hit on the poor, and where they might be expected normally to look to charities to come to their aid. Those charitable activities are going to be fewer and probably less generous. Now, I'll also note that in many Muslim majority countries, as you see here in the West, you're having some people sort of push back on restrictions on religious life. They want to continue things in normal, or they argue that now is the time more than ever for devotion and prayer. So you see those sort of contests going on. But again, I think it's going to be a very different Ramadan for many people.
No, it's a very interesting sort of tension that's playing out on, as you suggested, Jim, doubling down on religious observance and trying to adjust and deal with a more flexible approach. I mean, we saw it in my own family in terms of the Easter period, where there was no going to church services in most of Lent, as well as in Holy Week, and Easter Sunday was watched on a live stream in an empty church, and all sorts of practices that are normally associated with that were suspended. Now, you have, in the case of the Catholic Church, you have, unlike other major world churches, you have this hierarchy. You have the Vatican issuing out guidance or suggesting that its bishops can do so. In the Muslim world, I think it might go country to country, depending on some local Islamic leader. So it might be interesting to see whether or not they relax any of the requirements requirements. I've seen some reports, for example, that healthcare workers in Muslim countries being asked to deal with some of these 16-hour days, a big portion of which they would not be eating or drinking, might be too much to bear. So it'll be interesting to see whether they are issuing any sort of relaxation.
Yes. Well, there are dispensations given to people suffering certain illnesses from the requirement to fast. And I would imagine, again, depending upon your mosque prayer leader, those will be extended, though they may vary sort of in how they're individually defined. But again, we're sort of seeing what everyone is facing with is that the pandemic is disrupting ordinary day-to-day life. Now, some people will be fortunate, will have the technology. If you can't have your iftar dinner with family and friends present, maybe you could do it virtually. Obviously, I know a lot of people over Passover held their seders on Zooms and similar technology. But obviously, I think for a lot of people, simply won't have that capacity to do it, and their life is going to be disrupted even more than otherwise would be. Bob, we reached the time of the show where we talk about our figures of the week. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a number, and it is the number 15, and that is the number of mostly veteran pro-democracy activists who were rounded up by authorities in Hong Kong in the past week for a range of what were considered subversive activities related to demonstrations that were seen as unlawful. And these are include people like Martin Lee, who's one of their big veterans of Hong Kong's democracy cause and trying to keep the flames burning for the basic law that is supposed to guide governance in Hong Kong. I raise this, Jim, because there are concerns among democracy activists that China is using to cover the pandemic to intensify crackdowns on people like demonstrators, on certain sectors of society, media, what have you, that could be seen as disruptive and further causing a weakening of support of the Communist Party and of the central government at this time when the pandemic has certainly hurt China and hurt China's image, at a time when the economy was already weakening and there's concern about economic unrest percolating throughout the country and what that could mean as well for the authority and for respect for authority. So it's worth watching. The Hong Kong activists themselves have been as ever vocal in protesting what has taken place in the past week, saying, look to this as a tripwire for some other events going on. Some have even noted the intensifying exercises by Chinese military craft in the Taiwan area, saying, you know, China's using this to push the boundaries on what had been normal behavior vis-a-vis Taiwan or even in the South China Sea. So it is another backdrop to the pandemic, Jim. In this case, it's China growing in assertiveness, whether it's domestic dissent or in its role in its so-called near abroad.
Do we have a sense, Bob, of how vibrant the pro-democracy movement is in Hong Kong now that the coronavirus pandemic has pretty much eliminated the ability to congregate in large numbers to protest the pressure that Beijing is putting on the Hong Kong government?
What we've seen in terms of the reaction to this this sweep of the past week was, you know, a great deal of using, you know, social media and other ways of getting the word out amongst the community of activists that showed that they were not necessarily cowed. But this is definitely hurting the ability of this very feisty community of activists to be able to get out in the streets, which is what they had done remarkably in the past year. Just not being able to congregate as a public health matter has, I think, defeated them in ways that the pro-Chinese government's crackdown has not been able to. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the authorities test this period of time, whether or not there is an easing or there are calculations made on easing back to business and back to normal, shall we say, that are made also with a mind towards public gatherings in Hong Kong. Because Hong Kong's in that kind of gray area. It dealt vigorously with the crackdown. It actually shed light on what was happening in Wuhan earlier than other Chinese media, certainly. And yet they don't want to see a second or third wave happen. And they don't want to see like what happened in Singapore, as you mentioned earlier, Jim. And they've had some other cases flare up recently in Hong Kong. So they're in this very touchy, tricky situation right now where I think you have a community of people who would be quick to get back out in the streets if they needed to or stage some of their more serious demonstrations or wide-scale demonstrations and can't do it right now. Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person. It's Kim Jong-un, the 36-year-old leader of North Korea. Rumors have it that he is in grave condition after recent surgery. Critical word here is rumors. He hasn't been seen in public since April 11th, and he was a no-show on April 15th for what is traditionally North Korea's most important public event, the annual celebration of the regime's founder, Kim's deceased grandfather. Now, this story about Kim Jong-un's ill health broke on a South Korean website, which reported that he had undergone cardiovascular surgery. Now, there have been reports of Kim's demise before. Those obviously didn't turn out to be true. And there's an extra layer of mystery added on all of this because North Korea's news outlets have been entirely silent on the story, haven't taken any efforts to knock it down. Now, big question here, of course, is if he is sick and does pass, who would succeed him? Now, he has only one direct family member, that's his younger sister, Kim Yo-jong, who is rumored to be politically powerful. But again, we're not really sure what is happening. Senior South Korean officials say there's nothing to see here. They don't detect any unusual activity taking place in North Korea. President Trump was asked about Kim Jong-un during a press conference this week, and he said, "I just hope he's doing fine because the two of them have a very good relationship." And I'm going to quote the president again, "I'd like to see him do well, and we'll see how he does, but we don't know if the reports are true." So again, this is one of these things where there may be a lot of it do about nothing, or it may be the case that something significant is happening in North Korea, which could really sort of change the conversation about the future of developments on the Korean Peninsula.
No, it was quite a thing to see the reports coming furiously at the end of a day when typically you're seeing reports related to various new pandemic stats or activities or whatever. And suddenly it's a North Korean leadership succession brouhaha seemingly rising up. So what we know, Jim, just to be sure, is that he was having some sort of heart procedure, but we don't know how he came through it, or that even that is that the subject of unconfirmed reports?
We actually don't know what kind of surgery Kim Jong-un had, Bob, or if he had surgery at all. Again, there's reporting that suggests he has had it, but the particular details simply aren't known to us. I do think it's clear that the U.S. government is following this quite closely and trying to determine what actually is transpiring, again, because of the consequences of what could happen if you were to see Kim Jong-un incapacitated or to die. There's the potential for a leadership succession fight, given, remember, this is a country that has nuclear weapons and nuclear materials. Concerns become who has control over those materials, who has control of the military more broadly. Again, this is something that could really shake up events on the Korean Peninsula.
And it comes at a time before his non-appearance, Kim's non-appearance, where North Korea was, again, pushing the boundaries on some of its testing, its missile testing, for example, and certainly its rhetoric was getting sharper again. President Trump, who does have seemingly a good personal relationship with Kim, has not been able to get him to denuclearize by any metrics that intelligence officials are watching. So it is a great deal of concern. And it's, as always with North Korea, is it a question of, you know, what we know now being further casting this very dangerous state into a further area of danger, or is it opportunity at the same time?
And of course, there's also the question of, will this intersect in any way with the coronavirus pandemic? There have been stories that infection rates are high in North Korea. But again, this is a totally closed society, no transparency. So we don't know what are simply rumors, what's speculation, what's gossip, and what the actual facts are on the ground.
And it's worth, I think, as always, it's worth keeping an eye on what the South Koreans are reporting. They follow this stuff, by all accounts, very closely. Sources are better than any others. So I think we'll keep an eye on their reporting for now and take it from there. And that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. NASA marks the 30th anniversary of the Hubble telescope launch, and Armenians mark Genocide Commemoration Day.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anu Kumar, Claire McGraw, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay safe.